Well, good morning. I thank you guys so much for being here, and I just always look forward to the pageant. It's familiar. I mean, we've been seeing kind of this story over and over again, and yet there's something about, well, I think the importance of having it depicted by children that brings about a sort of freshness and reality to the story. I was talking with Toby about this because she's thinking, oh gosh, anything could happen, right? Like this idea of herding cats. And it really is true. But what I was telling her is we all look forward to that. Are you kidding? That's like the gold in this thing is these sort of spontaneous disruptions that happen in the midst of it. And it was making me think, there's a story that we read as family every year at Christmas. Does anybody out here read The Best Christmas Pageant Ever? Are you familiar with this? Okay, like, yeah, nobody. See, I mentioned this to my staff, and only Toby had read it, that The Best Christmas Pageant Ever is about these kids, the Herdmans, that, and maybe this will ring a bell as I'm telling this, they're like the bad kids at school, and this family of just total dysfunction, and these kids are like the bullies, and they pick on everybody, and one of the kids says to one of the Herdmans, well, I don't care, you know, I get all the candy I want at Sunday school. So all the Herdmans show up one Sunday, and it just happens to be the Sunday where they're handing out the parts to the Christmas pageant. And so the Herdmans basically hijack the whole thing, take over and fill all the roles from Mary and Joseph to the wise men to the angel of the Lord. And so this idea of, like, you know, them being sore afraid, all these little kids are terrified, and there's just chaos for the next few months. The lady who normally leads the pageant breaks her leg. And so the one telling our story, it's her mother that ends up taking over the pageant. And so anyway, you just see this whole disaster awaiting. And in the end, of course, is brilliant. And I thought I would read you just a little bit from it. But, you know, one of the great moments is these kids end up having just this beautiful encounter with the Lord. And the wise men, instead of bringing in their bath salt jars, just bring in this ham that was donated to them through the welfare system, and they just lay this thing on the stage, thump. And so anyways, that's in this little part that I'm reading. The father is kind of, you know, as they're tearing everything down, says, I guess that's everything. As we stood at the back of the church, all over now, it was quite a pageant. Then he looked at my mother. What's that you've got? It's the ham, she said. They wouldn't take it back. They wouldn't take any candy either or any of the little Bibles. But Imogen did ask me for a set of the Bible story pictures, and she took out the Mary picture and said it was exactly right, whatever that means. I think it meant that no matter how she herself was, Imogen liked the idea of the Mary in the picture, all pink and white and pure looking, as if she never washed the dishes or cooked supper or did anything at all except have Jesus on Christmas Eve. But as far as I'm concerned, Mary is always going to look a lot like Imogen Herdman. Sort of nervous and bewildered, but ready to clobber anyone who laid a hand on her baby. And the wise men are always going to be Leroy and his brothers, bearing ham. When we came out of the church that night, it was cold and clear with crunchy snow underfoot and bright, bright stars overhead. And I thought about the angel of the Lord, Gladys, with her skinny legs and dirty sneakers sticking out from under her robe, yelling at us everywhere, hey, unto you a child is born. It's a super sweet story. We just totally enjoy it. But I think we need some of that, because that tendency of us to paint this story in a way that is so calm and serene and picture perfect really goes right against the whole texture of the story. It is a story that in many ways is chaotic. It's a story of huge risk, huge consequence. People stepping out in faith, following a journey where they have really, in the end, very little understanding of how the events are going to unfold. There's all kinds of danger. There's all kinds of risk. And the story unfolds in a way that in our familiarity could start to seem normal, but really, in the details we find, is anything but. In Isaiah, it says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. And the coming of Jesus comes with these signs that are given. And sometimes I think we think almost that those are in order to predict this event that's about to take place. But I don't really think that's how signs work. Signs are not predictions as much as symbols given so that when the event occurs, you're ready. But that process of waiting, Isaiah writes those words 700 years before Jesus is born. And you can imagine what that would have been like to be waiting in anticipation for something that is going to happen and then doesn't happen and doesn't happen. I was thinking it must be like a lifeguard just staring, waiting for something to happen, right? And the idea of you know what to look for and you know kind of what to watch for, but no wonder at some point that people are nodding off. These signs, we need signs. We look for signs all the time, but we look for those ones that just grab our attention, right? We look for things that are viral. We look for things that have 17 million views, and then we want to get on board and check out whatever the spectacle is. And this is just sort of human nature. We're drawn to these things that are flashy and grab our attention, right? It's the whole advertising world feeds off of basic human physics of what draws our attention. I remember having a professor that was visiting from England, and he was like, my goodness, what is it with you guys in weather? Every time I turn on the weather, it's like storm watch, you know? And this idea of what we're drawn to this sort of calamitous thing, and the news kind of operates off of this sort of fear thing, and everything gets stirred up. These are the kind of signs that we want, right? When it comes to this, these are the signs that grab our attention. And it's an interesting thing when it says a sign has been given, when these signs have been spoken. What we find is that they exist in these almost opposite spheres that are both kind of out of reach of where we naturally tend to go. We operate our lives in this sort of sphere of comfortability and manageability here. And yet two of the most prominent signs occur outside of that sphere and at the very heart of it. I think sometimes the grandiosity that we can handle, the spectacle, happens again in this area of control. And we don't allow ourselves to go much outside of that. I was thinking about this just by way of example in that movie Gravity. Did you see Gravity? At one point, she comes untethered, which, spoiler alert, sorry about that. But all of a sudden, this moment of Sandra Bullock floating into the vastness of space. And I'm sitting there watching this movie, and my palms are just like dripping sweat because, my goodness, what an image, right, of the grandiosity that's out there. And sometimes I would just rather not know. It's like keeping the light on at night. I just don't want to know how big things really are. I want this manageable sphere. And we have this powerful symbol that comes into play where this star comes in, this star of Bethlehem. There's been a ton of fascination about this. People are wondering what it is, and some of the timing is kind of tricky because we don't exactly know the exact dates and questions about when did Herod die and how does this all fit. But there's a few theories that are out there, and the one that I like the most is this one where Jupiter, it ends up coming into conjunction with this star Regulus that's in this cluster of stars that's known as Leo, thank you. And this takes place like in 3 BC. And it would have given something that would have appeared. I think it comes into conjunction like three times that year. So if there was magi actually traveling, they would have seen the significance of this. I mean, that the lion, right? The royalty that depicts, the power that depicts, but also Israel. And this idea of Jupiter as this royal star and Regulus as this star of kingship all coming together, and maybe these magi are traveling and following this, it goes through this retrograde loop, which means that it would have at one point stopped and then looked like it was going backwards in the night sky. And that day that it stops there, guess what day that is? December 25th. Could just be a total fluke. And like these little things, because December 25th seems like it's kind of an arbitrary later date that's set, you know, and people go, no, it was actually set. I don't know. All I'm saying is this idea of a star, whatever the heck that was, is this display of power and might that is way beyond what we can comprehend. That these things come and they align in such a way that no man could control. And we just sit and watch as this thing hangs there in the sky. People go, well, it's kind of weird. I mean, if that were all the case, you know, some people don't like this example because they're like, it involves so much astrology and doesn't the Bible speak against that, right? So it's kind of breaking the rules, and maybe that's true. But it is interesting that the only people that really saw this sign in the sky were a bunch of astrologers that got it right. And it's funny the way information is given and who sees it and who doesn't. Because this whole story sort of breaks the rules all the way along and comes even with some consequences of that. I think about Joseph, and we heard the story told today of this angel coming. Joseph is referred to as Joseph the Just, and that was not just merely a description of his character. That would have been a title that he possessed, meaning one who is a keeper of the law, maybe even on a sort of rabbinical track, so to speak. That Joseph was a man that was respected and held in esteem in the community. And when he gets this bit of information about his wife, when he finds out she's pregnant, he's thinking, okay, how do I handle all the social dynamics of this in such a way that it doesn't bring harm to Mary, but I can keep myself clear and clean? And an angel tells him, no, marry her, which is pretty much the end of his career track. All of a sudden now it's just Joseph the carpenter, right? Because what came with that is a whole loss of moral standing, a whole place that he existed and held within his community was all of a sudden stripped from him out of obedience to the angel. And think about that. I mean, that's, you go, what? And yet, this is not an uncommon theme throughout Scripture, that we're constantly putting together these systems that tell us who's in the right and who's in the wrong. And we often find as we're going through it that God's not overly concerned with that, or at times even seems to change his mind as he goes. I love that story about Peter being told to eat this food, and he's like, God, I will not disobey you. And he's like, you're disobeying me. Eat. Right? And you see the tension and the paradox of this, and yet this idea that God is stretching and growing something. There's this sign given, I'm taking you somewhere. Yet as he leads him out of there, he leads him into this place that could seem very unspectacular and in fact like it was a huge mistake. I mean, you think about him going to Bethlehem and they're showing up at an inn to try to find a place. His wife is going to give birth to the Son of God, and they're like, sorry, buddy, you can sleep in the garage. And so they end up giving birth to Jesus like in this garage. And you think about that in our standards of hygiene and our expectations on how that is. And we can't even imagine what that must have felt like. But he must have known that vision, that dream from the angel must have left a huge impression. Because he was willing to really, on his own, go at tremendous risk and tremendous loss to follow that sign. Something in his heart knew, this is true, this is all that mattered, and this is worth staking everything on. Mary as well. So you see this, interpreting the signs has this way of dismantling our realm of comfortability and taking us into this place of tenderness and vulnerability, of a lack of familiarity, of risk, always risk. Richard Rohr says this, it has little to do with the right rituals, only the right reality. And I think that this dismantling that goes on is something that God does. He comes into our sense of rules and order and has this delicate way, sometimes not so delicate way, of taking things apart. I love this from Walter Brueggemann. He says, the world for which you have been so carefully prepared is being taken away from you by the grace of God. And see, God does this. God like builds us, constructs in us this sense of order and rules and stability, and then yet has to come in and in that delicate dismantling reveal to us that there's more, that we build a false ceiling out of that that only lets us grow so far. And so God comes in and creates that space through exposing areas that we've held on to and attached to too strongly. Jesus enters into the world, and not just in a manner that is uncomfortable for us to grasp, but into a situation that in many ways is unimpressive and lacks significance in the world's eyes. I remember reading Donald Miller one time talking about how if Jesus was born today, he would be born in some middle American town and speak with a hillbilly accent and be missing a tooth. And you'd see him on CNN and you would immediately go, who's this guy? What does this guy have to say? Where did this guy go to school? What has this guy done that's of any sort of prominence and significance to society? But what you see again and again is that God is just almost disinterested in that whole system. He's constantly operating in these spheres, one far bigger than we can imagine and one far, far smaller. And so the Jews, when they saw the Messiah had come, went, yay, we're being saved from the Romans. And you almost see Jesus going, Rome is irrelevant. We're dealing with hearts that are immortal. And we're talking about eternity. And Rome is like a little blip on the radar. It's a little small step in history. And yet we stake our whole lives, our whole meaning, our whole value system on Rome and on that sphere of the world. And Jesus is constantly saying, set your eyes on things above and guard your heart because it's the wellspring of life. So to read God's signs and to read them accurately, we have to be looking bigger and we have to be looking smaller than what we see. And this is what we get in this story of Jesus coming to earth, this incarnational story in this tiny little moment. I love how Chesterton, he says, Bethlehem is emphatically a place where extremes meet. And I think he's right that you have the power that created the universe, this helpless little child that has to be fed. You have everything of significance coming in this manner that is totally insignificant. You have everything glorious in a situation that looks so small and so easily missed. And yet if we're reading the signs correctly, we realize in that moment everything changes. And you look at a calendar and history is literally split in half by this moment. Everything changes from that coming of Christ. Everything is set in motion. There's things that have been foretold that have come about, and yet this plan for things being set right begins in this moment with Jesus coming to earth. I want to read the story from Matthew. And then I want to talk about it as we understand it in light of what does this mean? Because the theme of this morning is love. And this gift that is given, really, in essence, this is the greatest thing given. And in us understanding this thing, not just the human component, but this divine component of it, it changes the way we live, it changes how we see ourselves, it changes how we see others. That understanding this unlocks our greater purpose, but also sets us free to be who we were made to be. This from Matthew 1, 18 through 25. It says, now the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. And her husband Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. But as he considered these things, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary as your wife. For that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. When Joseph woke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded. He took his wife, but knew her not until she had given birth to a son, and he called his name Jesus. And then this from 1 John chapter 3, 17 through 24. It says, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. By this we shall know that we are of the truth and reassure our heart before him. For whenever our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart, and he knows everything. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. Whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do what pleases him. And this is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his son, Jesus Christ, and love one another. Just as he has commanded us, whoever keeps his commandments abides in God, and God in him. And by this we know that he abides in us, by the Spirit whom he has given us. And here's a summation. Because of this, this is what happens, an outpouring of love. This is an indwelling of love. It's an abiding presence of God that fills and then flows out. It's these two paintings. And what I love about this and these two things standing together is that they represent two different things and yet two inseparable pieces of this equation. You guys hear that, or is that just me? Somebody's GPS just went off. There's a necessary infilling and then a necessary outpouring. And that these two things cannot exist without the other. The fact is that this, if it pours in, this joy that God pours in and fills us with, if that's somehow kept to ourselves, I think really in the end it goes bad. That it becomes still water, that it becomes tainted. And that's the thing. It's similar to the way, like, it's God providing this manna from heaven, right? You remember this story where God gives this food to Israel, and they, manna just means like, what is it? They don't know what this stuff is. They just eat it, but then they eventually go, well, let's store it up and keep it for tomorrow in case God doesn't show up. And they open it the next day and it's all rotted, right? And I think that there's a similar sort of thing, that this joy is something that's meant to flow through us, right? And so this outpouring becomes critical, this sense of pouring ourselves out, emptying ourselves. And the reason that I think that this is so important to see this almost in two different stages, I think that indwelling, gosh, it is just a joyous feeling. And I think that feeling of pouring out and loving others is an emptying feeling. It's a costly feeling. It has a texture of sacrifice, even at times of suffering. And I think sometimes we think of love in a sort of nostalgic sense, when in fact love is for the purpose of transformation. It changes. And there's a worldly sort of love that is a beautiful thing that is, I think, found often in friendship, but also often this is a sort of mutual admiration that comes in friendship, which is it's a wonderful gift, and it's not to minimize that. But I think when Jesus describes love, he sets this in a different category of the divine. I'll just read a little bit from the Sermon on the Mount. He says, "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing? What more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And this perfection is this complete outpouring, this complete selflessness that all of us are in some process of working towards. And I think little by little by little. And yet you see this giving of ourselves, not just to those who reciprocate, but really where it matters is giving to those who cannot. Which is why James would say pure religion is giving to the widows and the orphans, giving to those who have nothing to give in return. But this idea of loving your enemies, what a radical concept, and what a scary, risky concept. Because you're going, well, if I go into this and if I go into it in faith, then I'm not going to suffer, right? Well, wrong. I mean, you think about this season that we're in the Christmas season, and so many of you are suffering right now, and I know because we talk about it, and there's a heaviness and a burden that comes often in this time. And some of it, interestingly enough, comes in the idea of just families coming together, right? And the difficulty that that brings. And honestly, in the wounds that are there. and the things about ourselves, the wounds that we carry and that we bear, the things that like we have the hardest time forgiving in others, and the way we feel about ourselves oftentimes, and we just go, oh gosh, how do I set limits and boundaries to this? Some of that's healthy. But when you think about the whole texture of this, this idea of entering in, engaging on this, of going, God, pour out my joy, your joy through me. How do I pour out my love to others? How do I meet them in such a way that my heart just gives generously? That costs. And you can finish up with that and feel like, gosh, I don't feel full right now. I feel empty. And God goes, come back, wait on me, and I'll fill you, and I'll sustain you, and I'll be your strength. But that idea of outpouring, it hurts, and yet it's a necessary thing for us, because as we pour out to others, God is transforming our own hearts. As we step out in obedience, our hearts get bigger. That's what it says in Psalm 119, that God enlarges our hearts. And through that, we're able to run in the way of his command. But this process, I think, is a costly one. I think that image, sometimes you're giving and you're thinking, will I ever be filled back up? I think this is the risk that we take in love. And yet I think God is saying, you have no idea what seems so small here. Really, if you could see it in its proper scale, you would realize this is the most powerful thing that is happening in the universe right now, is these simple little gifts of love. Chesterton, he says that in this moment in Bethlehem, the whole universe flips on his head. I want to put this quote up here. It says, the whole universe had been turned inside out. I mean that all the eyes of wonder and worship which had been turned outwards, the largest thing, were now turned inward to the smallest. But it is true, in a sense, that God, who had been only a circumference, was seen as a center. And a center is infinitely small. It is true that the spiritual spiral henceward works inwards instead of outwards, and in that sense is centripetal instead and not centrifugal, for all you physics people. The faith becomes, in more ways than one, a religion of little things. And I love this. This is what gives us a starting point. This is like feeding the 5,000 with just a simple meal, that we take this little thing that we have and we give it, and we give it and we pour it out and we empty it. And God takes it and uses it and does far more than we can ask or imagine. And this becomes, as we start to recognize how God works, this is always what he's up to, is pushing us towards that place. Towards that place where we're anxious, towards that place where we're fearful. And I often have that sense of going, oh no, you're going to ask now for this. Can you relate to that feeling? Okay, God, I'll give you this, but can that be it? And you know he's going, this will do for now, Jeff. But I'm going to ask you for more, and I'm going to ask you for more. There's times where I just think, I just can't. Because you can't. Right? Little by little by little. Those little steps God sees with just such value. It's the widow giving those mites and Jesus saying, there it was. You missed it. And all the spectacle of this guy pouring all this money into the money changers thing. And this woman has given more than all. And he speaks to Joseph through an angel. And that roots him. That's what he needs to hear. And God speaks to us in different ways. My hunch is in ways that are just right for you. Do we have the eyes to see what God is saying about each one of us? Because he does. And they echo, but they're subtle. And if we're not looking, or if we're not bringing the right value system to it, it's like white noise and we just miss it. It's too big or it's too small. But when you start hearing that voice, that still small voice, to Elijah, it comes in the sound of silence itself. That quiet voice, and God speaks. God speaks right to the center of our hearts. And he speaks to us words of love that are so rooted and so powerful that it roots our identity in something that all of a sudden is filled with strength. And sometimes that's the simplest thing. was sitting with Megan and her daughter Addison in my office this last week, and you know, I think it's such an interesting thing that in the midst of the storm is often where we hear the voice louder than in other places. And I think God does that out of consideration as we enter into the storm, that voice gets louder. We've talked about if you want to see God, you got to move to where he's working. If you want to hear God, right, you're stepping in to these moments, these storms. You're stepping out of a boat like Peter did into the storm. And that's where you hear God's voice. And I've been hearing this echo from God recently. We're out of time. I'll wrap it up. But I feel like God's been saying like three things, and I'm not going to tell you what they are. I'll tell you one of them. Save the rest for later. But it's funny because they've been coming from all different areas. And, you know, I've got friends that are like all so different, and they probably all are suspicious of each other. And yet I see God echoing and echoing and echoing these words to me in ways that he does that are just, grabs my heart. But a friend of Sally Eimer's came up to me last Sunday, and she said, you know, I was sitting out there and God told me to tell you these three things, boom, boom, boom. And it was all three, and they were all like dead on, right on the money. And I was telling Patty, gosh, if she gave me 3 out of 10 right, I would have been impressed. But 3 out of 3 was unbelievable. But as I was talking to Megan and to her little daughter, Addison, because we were talking about what does God say to you? And she said, what does he say to you? And I said, well, I'll tell you what he's telling me right now. He's telling me to be myself. That's it. Just be yourself. I thought, oh gosh, there's such freedom. But I think when we exist in this middle realm where we're not, or what everybody else wants to see, or everybody expects us to believe, the transformation that God is doing in our hearts is the most intimate, vulnerable kind. But he speaks to us, this is who you are. This is where you've been. This is who you are. This is where you're going. You're my beloved. I think, wow, when that takes root in our hearts, we can go on a journey like this. We can give birth to a child in a manger. We can leave behind our reputation in the eyes of our community and go, God, I'll go where you call me to go. Some of you need to hear that this morning, and I want to pray that for you, for all of us, that we would hear those signs that would empower us to be those people that love and pour blessing with generous hearts, pour ourselves, empty ourselves out on those around us. But before we close, this from Richard Rohr. Can you throw that last one up there? Authentic God experience gives you another place to stand, another identity, a spacious and gracious place, which invites you to stand outside of the dominant consciousness that surrounds you and everybody accepts as reality. Authentic God experience liberates you from the usual domination systems, liberates you from needing everything to be perfect or right, and liberates you to be who you really are, ordinary and poor, just like everybody else. Is that so good? Gosh, there's just freedom in that. Just freedom to be who you are. God's saying it's enough. He's saying you're my beloved child. That person right there. And that we just step forward with obedience. Would you stand? We're going to close our service. And thanks so much for being here. And I'm going to invite some people down that will pray with you if you would like prayer, especially on this. If your heart is stirred, please remain after and pray with us. But as you go, I would pray that God would bless you and keep you. That he would make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. That he would lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Amen. Merry Christmas.